class today? If we could quiet down, we'll begin. Great, thank you. So, we'll spend some time talking about test two. Test two is too long. This was my fault. I tried to put more smaller questions than I have in the past instead of a fewer larger questions and misjudged how much this would change the time you take on it. So there are lots of ways of telling it was too long, but short answer is it was too long. In the field of analytic design for examinations and so on, long tests have high standard deviations. This messes up the standard grading scale where we assume that the best to worst student has only a variation of 40 on 100. So we tweaked that. So if you look in TPEGS, you'll see the untweaked grades with a very wide span. And then if you look in your test grades, you'll also see what that is once we narrow down that span to the relatively arbitrary span imposed by the letter grade system. So that's what's happening. After the adjustment, so in the sort of standard scale, mean and median are both right around 85. We had a perfect score, and we had somebody who did nothing but fill in their email ID and sign the pledge. So we have everything from 0 to 100 is the range. So we'll go over the individual points of that and the questions and how they're graded and so on. Today. Before we though go into that and then talk some about some of the material we want to cover today as well, any questions, comments, concerns for me? Yes? The answer is on Colab. I downloaded it from the student view just 10 minutes ago, so I know it actually exists. Any other questions? Okay, well, let's just go over the exam. All right, so the first page. I didn't assign points to bubbling in your ID. This turned out to be a bad move. About 30 of you didn't bubble in your ID. This caused me huge amounts of headache and grumpiness. Bother. Okay, question one. Most of you just got this right, except a lot of you got the second part of part B wrong. Okay, array lists, how do we change an element in array? We use the set method. The add method inserts a new element, sliding other things along. So a lot of you put add instead of set. That was wrong. Set was right. There it was. If at any point I talk about one of these and want me to explain more than I'm about to explain, raise your hand or yell so I can hear you, and I will do so. All right, so how do you find the smallest element of an array? You look at everything in the array and compare it to what you think is the smallest. The trick here is figuring out what the first smallest thing should be. Far too many of you assumed that the smallest thing could start out at 0, which will not work if we give you a negative array, where every element in it is negative. So we have here roughly how the points are broken down. You had a loop over the elements of x. You initialized some sort of counter for the minimum. You updated it in an appropriate way. This would work if you had a list of negative numbers and you return an int. Okay? So this is one appropriate solution. The most common mistake I saw was people who started this at 0 instead of at an actual element of the array. Okay, this is the fun one, arrays. All right, so I suggested you might find it easier if you draw boxes and arrows. Almost none of you did. I guess you don't like drawing. But anyway, so we'll talk about how you do it without boxes and arrows, because that's apparently how you all want to do it. So, x sub 0. To figure out what x sub 0 is, we sort of work our way backward to the program to the first place it was assigned, or last place it was assigned. So the last place we assign x sub 0 is x sub 0 of x sub 0. Ooh, that's weird. Okay, so what was x sub 0 before that? It was 2. So what is x sub 2? It was 5. So this right here assigns a 5 into x sub 0. So 5 is the answer. The next line does x sub 1. We never modified x sub 1, so it's just the x sub 1 that was already there. And x sub 2? was 5. We modified that, but we modified it without changing it. We change it from 5 to 3 plus 2. It's still 5. How long is the Y array? Well, it is X sub 2 long, which was 5. Okay? What was the first thing in the Y array? We assigned it to high, so the answer is high. What is the one thing in the Y array? We never assigned it. Arrays are initialized with 0, false, or null. If we never assign it, the answer is null. Okay? Z was this two-dimensional array which we created. Okay? We created it as being a 2x2 array. We put 1 in the first position and replaced the second row with X. So in 0, 0 is 1 because we assigned it to be 0, 0. In 0, 1 is 0 because we never assigned 0, 1. And int arrays are initialized to 0, right? The 0, false, or null. 0 works for ints. So we got a 0 for the Z sub 0 sub 1 spot. The Z sub 1 sub 1 spot. Well, we changed Z sub 1 to mean the same thing as X. So this will be the same thing as X sub 1, which was 3. And that was that one. And maybe we talk more about any of those pieces. Yes?
For the very last one, wasn't Z an array, like it had two array of two, and then within each it had another array?
Yes. Yes. This is not quite changing the length. I didn't bring my other drawing pad, so let me see if I can do that here. All right. So Z is an array of two things. Just, can people see? Anybody cannot see what I'm drawing on the board? Okay, so Z is an array of two things. Initially, both of those things are pointing to arrays of two numbers. Okay? And then we modify the first one to be a 1. And then we modify... that's the wrong array. Sorry. Modify the first one to be a 1. So Z sub 0 sub 0 becomes a 1. But then we say Z sub 1 equals X. We are changing this box to point to whatever X was pointing to, which was a 3-element array. So we just change what's in this box. Sorry, not what's in that box. What's in this box? To talk about that array. Okay? So does this change the length of Z sub 1? Yes, because it changes the entire array Z sub 1 is talking about. The original array that was there hasn't changed, but we've changed which array it's talking about. Does that answer the question? Yes. Other questions? Okay. Reverser. Okay, so you needed to write a method that reverses an array into an array list. We didn't give you the method header. We wanted to see if you could write one. About half of the points in this assignment were with a method header. Okay? So we told you it should be public static, so you should have gotten public static. We showed you it should be called reverse, so hopefully you got reverse. We say, given a single copy of array as a parameter, an array of strings as a parameter, and it should return an array list containing a copy of the array. So we want an array list of strings. So that's the method header. That was half of the points for this problem. And then what you need to do is you need to copy what was in one thing over into the other. Okay? There are lots of correct ways to do this. But all of them involve some kind of looping through the array and putting the things into the array list. So one way to do that is I start at the last legal index. I keep going as long as I haven't reached the first legal index, and I go down by 1, and I add them to the array list, okay? So a lot of people tried something like this. There are other correct ways to do this. That's what this is. And we have a little breakdown of where the points went, right? You needed to make an array list. You needed to return it. Relatively little points went to figuring out how to make it go backwards correctly, because we were more interested in your understanding of the methods at this particular example. Questions? All right. How can you tell if something is describing a standalone action instead of a behavior? It's the word static. If you put something other than the word static, you were wrong. Depending on how sensible what you wrote was, we might have said something nice about giving you partial points there. How do you know something's a constructor? It has no return type. The place where a return type would exist is absent. Okay? There are other things true about a constructor. Okay, so for example, it has the same name as the class. That is true about a constructor. It's not something you can determine from one line of code, but we gave you fairly significant partial credit if you gave that particular wrong answer. Others as well. Questions about either of these? All right. What is wrong with this method? It won't return in all cases. So this code does not define what to return if x is 0. It actually has some other reasons it won't define what to return as well, but there's that one fairly obvious one. Okay. So where is the problem? The problem's at the end of the method, or you could also say the problem's at the return type. We're particularly picky where you said it was. We're not always returning an int. That's the problem. And explain why you're not always returning an int. Okay. That was it. This method prints 7, not 3. Why? Because the x that becomes 3 is in a different method. It's a different scope. It is a different x variable. Some way of saying that was correct. You could even use the word passed by value, though very few of you did. Okay, so the 7 we are printing was this 7 here. It was not modified in any way by this method, because that method had its own x. Any question about these two? Yes?
So for the top one, when x equals 0, just like the method would still run, but it would return it okay. That's why it's a problem?
Yeah, so a method is required to either always return the same thing no matter what happens. So Java won't even let you compile a method, will give it a squiggly underline, not let you move forward, if there is some case where it cannot verify you will return something. You could not put this method in a legal Java class. You could not do anything with that class because this method is syntactically wrong.
Okay.
I don't know if that answers the question you asked or not.
Yes.
If I just put another return statement on the last line, then suddenly it would be fine. Yes?
If you put it in Eclipse, the error that comes up is that the method must return a type integer. So a lot of people get confused because they're saying, oh, like it, maybe it's not returning.
Okay, a good point. So what does Eclipse say for this? The error message in Eclipse, let's find out. Let's actually put this in Eclipse and see the error message. Hey, let me go to Eclipse. Let me make myself a new class. Whatever. I don't really care what it's called. I type this method in here and fix the formatting. For some reason it went wrong. Okay, and I look at the error message it gives me. The text of the error message is the method must return a result of type int. This is the generic error message it gives either if you're returning the wrong type or if you're not returning at all. In this particular case, I might not be returning. Negative 1's an int, 1's an int, but there's this extra case here where I'm not returning anything. I add that return statement, poof, it goes away. I could also make it go away by changing my second if to an else. Okay. I just need to guarantee that no matter what happens, something will be returned before I can use this class. Okay. So, I thought for a while that we had no ambiguities in this test, and I was very happy with that, but it turns out we had one, and it was in this question. It was this word right here. Okay? So some of you interpreted this as meaning how many times the parents were married, and some of you interpreted it as how many times the person was married. This actually happened in the TAs too. So some of you will see strange comments in your code and on your grade that suggests that the TA interpreted it the other way. How we didn't figure this out until halfway through grading, I don't know. Anyway, but in general, what do you need to do for this? You needed to have the person in the box. Most of you got that right. The second box needed to have fields. And we told you some things about them, right? There need to be at least two different types. Most of you got that. And then you have to have some way of storing what's interesting about people. So parents or children, age or birth or something that lets us compare ages, and some kind of marriage divorce information. We were fairly loose about what we allowed to count as marriage divorce information. How did I model this? A person has a father person, a mother person, a list of spouses, a list of divorcednesses, and a birth date. There are other ways to do it. This is just the way I did it when I was designing this. The methods needed to actually be methods. Which means they had to have parameter, return type, right? And we needed to have a constructor, at least one getter, setter, at least two things that were not getters or setters. Right, so you need to have at least two methods that did just something other than just change or return one of the fields you gave us. So that was some of the points there. And then you also needed to have, we graded you if you had the specifics. We are fairly loose. You didn't have to have all four of the basic things we said you could do, but we did want to see at least some of them. And so how did I do this? Get father, get mother. Marriage count, get the spouse of a particular marriage is how I decided to model this. See if this person is divorced from another person. Notice my is divorced person should only take one person parameter. The other one would be this. Okay? Similar for relationship too, or age difference. Okay? All of these should only take one person. And available doesn't need any because it doesn't depend on other people besides this. So that's what we had here. Questions about the diagram? Okay. Constructor. There wasn't a lot to do here. You check if the denominator is zero. If the denominator is zero, you do division. Sorry, if it's not zero, you do division. If it is zero, you set it to zero. You need to use this dot value. Notice the only field here is this as a value field. There is no numerator or denominator field. This dot numerator or this dot denominator don't work for this class because those fields don't exist. And so we specifically said you need to use good coding style, so we gave a point for that. A sad number of you didn't get that point. Okay, and then you need to check this, and you do need to do double division, otherwise most numbers are zero. Okay. So that's how that one went. Questions about that? And last but not least, intervals. Okay, so I did this all in one statement. Poof, there it is. Most of you didn't. That's fine. Okay. There's lots of equivalent ways of figuring out if two intervals overlap. So what did we grade it based on? Again, we had indentation. You should understand that this and other are two interval objects, and those are the two we are using. Most of you did that. Hurrah. This dot, we told you to use it. Most of you did. Did you get the overlap right? Okay, so there's at least three cases. They don't overlap. They overlap in partly, and then one's completely inside the other. A lot of you got all but one of these. So that happened. We told you that they should include the endpoints, so depending on how you run it, that means less than equal, greater than equal, something like that. And you should return a Boolean type, and we gave you some points if you just returned a Boolean type. And that was the exam. Any questions, comments, concerns about this exam? Yes, Jim?
Did you want to go over why the common kind of...
Huh. All right, so what was wrong? The most common solution to this was I check if this is small endpoint is inside other, and I check if this is large endpoint and is inside other. Or I check if other's small endpoint is inside this, and check if other's large endpoint is inside this. In other words, I'm finding one of the two intervals, and I'm seeing if its endpoints are inside the other. This does not include every case. Let's see if we could do an example here. Let's just do a text file, okay? All right, so we could have, what are the examples I gave here? Let's consider these interval pairings. Okay? So if we consider these interval pairings, the one where they don't overlap, most of you got this right. Although some of you said fun things like, if this is large endpoint is less than the other's large endpoint, and this is and this a small endpoint is less than the other's large endpoint, basically means just if this is smaller than other. So it would include this one. But usually you got this one right. This one, most of you got right too. In this case, either the smaller or the large of each endpoint is inside the other interval. That is an overlap. Hurrah! But it was this case that many people got wrong in one of its two forms. So if we write this out sort of in a stack, okay, so we can see that we might have one interval completely contained inside the other, and it might happen in either order, okay? So if all I do is check that this, let's say the first row here is this, if I only check that this is endpoints are inside other, or only check that other's endpoints are inside this, I will miss one of these two cases. Okay? And that was by far the most common response. We only took off a point if you did one of those two. Because of the many cases, you got most of them right, just missed the one. Questions, comments, concerns? Okay, let's just remind you a little bit about regrades. Okay. You may make a regrade request through TPEGs. You must do that by Sunday, April 13th, because Monday, April 14th, I'll process the regrades. And the way the system works, once I process the regrades, it's over. Going back and regrading after I've processed the regrades is an exceedingly large headache. So you must submit them before then, and I will grade them after then. If you submit a regrade, I might regrade your entire exam, not just what you asked me to regrade. To minimize the chance that I will do that, you should be very clear in what you want regraded. You should point exactly to the problem. You should point out how it's different, how your answer matches the key, but the points you got don't. Okay. If you do that, I will likely say, oh, let's just check and see if you're right, and give you the points. If you are vague or long-winded, I will say, I don't want to read this paragraph, and I'll just regrade your test, which may or may not be good for you. So that's that. Whew. Anything else we need to say about the test? If not, I will move on to other topics. Okay. So, let us move on to other topics. We talked last class some about sort of what is Java doing under the hood with classes. So we talked about static, we talked about null, we talked about passing them in and out of things. Topics that came from chapter 8 of the textbook. There's one sort of tangentially interesting topic in chapter 8. Section 8.10 talks about what's called the garbage collector. Okay? Why do I say this is tangentially interesting? Most of your time you can ignore the existence of this thing. But it is happening, and understanding this happening helps you understand what's going on in general in your code. So we use new a lot. We make new scanners, we make new strings accidentally by using the plus sign, we make new array lists, we make new stuff. We make new asteroids, new fragile asteroids, and birds, and so on. We'll do a lot of making new things. Every time we make something, Java needs to allocate some of the memory in your computer to remember what we know about that thing. And one of the things you may or may not have thought about, probably never thought about, is we never tell Java we are done with that object. We make new stuff, but we never get rid of it. Okay? And if we make new stuff and never get rid of it, we will run out of memory. Because your computer only has a few gigabytes, and it may take a billion creations to run out of that, but you will run out of it eventually. So Java has something called the garbage collector. Every once in a while, your program will halt without you knowing it for a few milliseconds, and Java will look at everything you've ever created and try to figure out if it's alive. Meaning that some part of your code might reference it indirectly or directly. And if not, it will consider this memory is garbage, and it will collect the garbage and free up memory. Okay? So, this happens. This happens all the time in Java, and in a lot of other languages too. There are languages that don't do that, but we sort of have this free recycling world, okay? You can generate as much junk as you want, Java will get it back for you. You don't have to worry about taking out the trash yourself. So this exists. The reason I think this is interesting is it leads us into thinking a little bit about what is Java actually storing, okay? So we're going to talk a little bit today about what's being stored. We're also going to see a couple new classes and how they interact to sort of talk about some of the nuances of Java and how this can impact how we write code. So let's talk about what is being stored. If I want to run a method, Java needs to put a lot of things in memory. First, it needs to put the code in memory. Right? The code you write has to be stored somewhere. We also have all those static fields we talked about, right? Things that are shared by all classes. We have to know what their values are, so it has to be somewhere in memory. We have to have the activation records, meaning the memory of the local variables and other information about what method is running right now and what was behind it, all stacked up. So we have this stack of these things that track our methods. And we have all of our objects, all of their fields have to be stored somewhere. So we're going to have what's called the heap of objects. That's where the garbage collector works. The garbage collector spends its life crawling through the heap. There's actually other things being stored as well. But all of this is happening. Java is remembering all of this stuff, storing it in different parts of your computer's memory. And that, I guess that's the big point here. So my plan is to walk over how this works a little bit with a little example class that hopefully will also reinforce some of the ideas of static. Reinforce some of the ideas about how one class can use another, how you can make class and modify classes, depending on how things go and what you feel like. We may add a few little bits and pieces to it as well. We'll then come back a moment and talk a little bit about where this leads us in understanding computers as a whole and being a good digital citizen, or whatever we call that. All right, so let's start with a kitten class. I have written a kitten class. You can download it from lecture notes. I'm going to walk through this kitten class. The basic idea I have for kittens is that kittens have fur, some weight, and they might be male or female. Some very small number of kittens are neither male nor female, but we'll ignore those for the moment. Okay? We are also going to keep track of the number of each kitten. We could try to name all of our kittens, but there's a lot of kittens and people reuse names a lot. So we're just going to keep track of a number. The first kitten, then the second kitten, and so on. So we got four fields for our kittens. Number for ounces and whether or not they are female. To facilitate this, we also have two static fields. We have a static field kitten count, which we are going to use to assign numbers to each kitten. So the count of total kittens that have ever existed is shared by all kittens. Okay, it doesn't belong to any particular one, so we make it static. We also have a static final. Remember, static final things are constants. So we have this constant decimal formatter that we're going to use to print out the ounces nicely. I made it a constant just to point out that we can make constants. Not for any other reason. I mean, it'll be a little faster because it's a constant. Basically, I'm just storing it as a constant so we can see that those exist. I also have only one constructor for my kitten, and it doesn't specify any of these things. Now, theoretically, by who you breed as your kittens, you can change their fur color. But we're just going to pretend every part of a new kitten is random. Random gender, a random weight, a random fur color, right? It all comes in random. Except the number. So what does our constructor do? It increases the kitten count. We created one more kitten. It sets this number to be the current count. There are 137 kittens. This is the last one created. This is kitten 137. We use a random number to decide the fur color. We might have a kitten with no fur, but that's very unlikely. We might have a kitten with tan fur, brown fur, black fur, white fur, shirt tortoiseshell fur, or tabby fur. There are other colors of kittens, but those are the ones I decided to write. Okay. And I sort of picked my numbers here a little bit lopsided, so that about 40% of all kittens by this are tabby. Okay, whatever. Kittens, when they are born, the average weight of a kitten is? Nobody knows. 3.5 ounces. Right? So our kittens are a little bit heavier than the average kitten, because our kittens will average instead 4.5 ounces. So we're going to have fat kittens, but that's okay. We'll deal with that. And we'll just pick we'll pick exactly 50-50 split of gender. Most gender for most types of animals is not quite 50-50, but I didn't bother looking up which it is for kittens, so that's what we got. So that's our kitten constructor. Any questions about the constructor? What it does or why it does? Any piece of what it does? All right. The only other thing we have here is a two-string method. A much more complicated two-string method than we've seen in the past. But all it does is just build a string. So we have kitten number, which is a either male or female kitten with whatever kind of fur it has, fur, weighing a nicely formatted number of ounces. Okay. So it's just creating a nice looking string for our kitten in several lines by adding things up. So we have a program that lets us find a particular kitten. Okay? So let's do this. Somebody, do we want a male or female kitten?
Male.
I hear more males than females. We're going to find a boy cat.
More kittens.
What kind of fur?
Tabby.
Okay, and how much should our kitten weigh?
7 ounces.
Okay, so we decided in advance what I want. I want a really fat kitten, tabby fur. I want a boy cat because I really want it to tear up the furniture, right? What am I going to do? I decide what I'm looking for. I'm going to create a cat kitten, and then I'm going to see if the string that describes the kitten contains what I'm looking for. If it doesn't, it's the exclamation point. So if it does not contain what I'm looking for, I'm going to say I'm rejecting this cat. Okay? And I'm going to make a new one. Okay? Because that's how you have to do it when you're birthing things, right? If you don't like this one, you just have to wait for another one to pop out. When we're done, we're going to say, congratulations, we found your kitten, and print out your kitten. Okay? So, let's try this. I run this method. Let's look at this whole output. So we rejected the first 10 kittens. We got a lot of females in the first batch. Look at that. Okay, let's run this again. Okay, so the first time our 11th kitten was exactly the kitten we were looking for. Aren't we lucky? Okay. Our male kitten with tabby fur weighing 7 ounces. The next time it took us 894 kittens to get another one. Okay. And so we can just see that we have all of these kittens that just, nope, sorry. Yes, this is a male kitten we have a male kitten with tabby fur, but it only weighs 6.3 ounces, and I want 7! Give me 7 or give me death, right? All right. So we just keep going until we find the right kitten. Okay? So a silly application. But here it goes. So, this silly application aside, I do. What happened to my code window? Ah, there we are. Okay. So, I have my ability to find kittens. Before I move on, start talking about what Java is doing under the hood and how we can tweak this in interesting ways. Comments, questions, or things you want me to change about this to see what happens. Yes.
So, how long can you get away with 7 ounces when
Yes. Good question. How did we ever get 7? We never actually got a critten that weighed 7 ounces. The trick is right here. Okay? Our ounce formatter is going to round our numbers. So, why will we never get 7 ounces? Let's do that first. Math.random returns a number as small as 0 or as big as 0.99999999999973. I may have got one too few nines. And it's in that range. And it's never any other number. It can't be 1, ever. So if I have something that's smaller than 1, and I multiply it by 5 right here, I'll get something that's smaller than 5. Add something that's smaller than 5 to 2, I'll get a number that's smaller than 7. We will never create an exactly 7-ounce kitten. Or heavier than that, either. However, the formatter is going to round this, and I said round it to 1 decimal place. When I created my formatter, I put just 1 decimal place there. Okay? So any number that is bigger than 6.95 will look like 7.0. So that allowed me to actually find a kitten weighing what I asked for. Any other questions about this? I should comment, if we made this just one extra digit of precision, we would not find a kitten within 800. We will find one eventually. We'll let this run for a bit. Okay? Because kittens, you know, I mean, they're easy, right? You just get 2 cats together and out comes a kitten. But let's think about this a little bit. I'm at about 500,000 kittens so far. Okay? Good, Jim.
You can do 0.0 half or octave.
Oh, thank you. Yes, this will never happen as I wrote it. Sorry. This won't happen because I only have one thing right there. Okay, let's run this. Ah, it only took 2,000. I thought 100,000 was a little bit much. Okay? But it's still, it's a lot bigger number than we had before. 10,000. But we are seeing just a moment ago 500,000 kittens being generated. So let's just think just a little bit about what that means is actually happening inside your computer. Okay, what does every kitten have? Every kitten has a number, a string, a double, and a boolean. So somewhere in your computer's code, the computer's memory, I'm going to make a file called the heap so that we can write what's happening. Okay? So some part of memory is called the heap, and every time it makes a kitten, it is going to have to store the information about a kitten. So it's going to have a kitten that has, we'll format this like it was a CSV file, so we're going to have a kitten number 1, we're going to say, has no fur, weighs 2.3, okay, so we need about 17 digits here, has some weight, and also has either true or false, okay? Each kitten takes up memory, okay? And they'll all in general have some different fields here, but every single one of these kittens needs to have some memory used to remember where it is. And that memory has to be somewhere in your computer. And it's not overly small, okay? So we've heard the term bytes before. We'll talk about what that means in just a moment. But we can identify how many bytes each one of these things takes up. So number takes up 4 bytes. String takes up another 4 bytes. So up to 8. Double bumps that up to 16 because double takes 4 bytes all by itself. We also need to know if it's female, that's just 1, so at least 17 bytes per kitten. Okay? So we have at least, at very minimum, 17 bytes. It turns out it's more like 50-something, because Java stores a lot of other stuff too. But we're going to pretend like it's just those 17 bytes. So if I end up with 500,000 cats, okay, let's suppose I have 500,000 kittens times 17 bytes. Who can do math quickly in their head? Let's round that up to 20 to make our life slightly easier. Okay? So to store 500,000 kittens of 20 bytes each, I'm going to need to store 10 million bytes. Okay? Or 10 megabytes. Okay? Enough to store, what, 2 or 3 MP3s? Just to store that number of kittens. At the very minimum, it turns out to be almost 3 times as much. Now, that's a lot of stuff. Okay? A byte is about as much as a character, so this is like, you know, a small library of just writing down stuff about cats. Which I suppose there are people who would be really excited to read that library, but I'm not one of them. But the other thing to note is this is about 10 megabytes. 10 megabytes is not very much, right? We have gigabytes on our computers. We could store, most of us could store in the neighborhood of 50 million cats, kittens on our computer before we ran out of memory. 50 million is a much nicer number, okay? But eventually we will run out of that. And if all I care about all those cats until the last one is that it isn't the right one, I don't want all that memory to be stuck in my computer just taking up memory with all these unwanted kittens, right? That's what, you know, we can find somebody who wants them. We don't. So what Java has is what it calls the garbage collector, which seems really cruel when you're talking about kittens. So what it's going to do is, as I am creating these kittens in my heap, once my heap gets too full, once I've got too many kittens that have been created, then I don't need to remember the old ones anymore. So it's going to go through each one of these and it's going to say, what other piece of code is talking about this kitten? And if the answer is none, it's just going to reclaim that memory. What other code is talking about this kitten? If the answer is none, it's just going to reclaim that memory, leaving holes. Leaving gaps that we can put new kittens into later. So the new operator actually does a lot of work. It looks for a hole where it could fit a new object. It tells the garbage collector this is who's talking about it. There's a lot of work going on behind the scenes to allow us to create hundreds of thousands of kittens without destroying our computer. Okay? And there are languages where you have to do that work yourself. You have to manually say, I'm done with this kitten, you can reuse the memory. Okay? But Java is nice, it does it for us. So that's the garbage collector. Questions about memory, about garbage collector, about the kitten's example? Yes?
So when does it actually get rid of that piece of memory? Like, if you were to do
Let's find out. Okay, this next thing I'm about to show you, you don't need to remember, but there is a method that gets called automatically by Java right before some object is destroyed. Okay, and it is called, so it's like toString, it's something we can override, and it's called finalize. Okay, so right before an object gets reclaimed by the garbage collector, it calls the finalize method to sort of let us know, I'm about to destroy this object, do whatever you need to do to help me. So let's just print something out. Let's print out, this has been reclaimed by the GC. Okay? So I just add this method, and now anytime some object gets reclaimed by the garbage collector, I'm going to find out about it. Then let's go over to find a kitten, and we run this. And if I look at this, I will see, well, this is actually going to take, all right, so it took a lot of runs to find a kitten. So at first it's just rejecting kittens. For the first 16,000 or so, we're good. 16, 60, we're just rejecting a lot of kittens. A lot of kittens. And then at some point, in this particular instance, right after we create 17,041 kittens, the garbage collector comes on. It's somewhat random when this happens. It depends partly on how many you've made and partly on timing of your operating system. It'll be different every time you run. But it comes on, and you notice it just starts throwing away some of the kittens. Okay? Reclaiming that memory to use it to remember about new kittens. Okay, and so it just comes here, and there's no obvious order here. 15565 goes first, and then 16374, and it just sort of wanders around. There's some sort of pattern there, but who knows what it's doing. It gets back a bit of memory, and then it can create two more kittens, and it says, oh, time to get rid of some more. Oh, and now we can create some more, and it just jumps back and forth doing this. How this works, there's a lot of stuff going on under the hood. And when exactly it will happen will vary each time you run the program. other questions? Okay. There's one more thing I want to talk about. So, you've probably all heard that computers only store ones and zeros. This is false. Computers only store voltages, high or low. That's it. There are no ones or zeros anywhere in there. So when I wrote in my heap, I wrote it like CSC. That was the wrong thing to do. What I should have done is written like 0.95 volts, 0.2 volts, 0.99 volts, 0.1 volts, high and low voltages. That's what's actually stored in your computer. Somewhere around 1 volt, somewhere around 0 volts. Depending on your chip, the high number might be higher than that. And that's all a computer can store. All memory, all processing, it's just doing volts. If you want to learn how that actually happens, you're welcome to take CS2330. It goes into that in some detail. But we can interpret that however we want. So in general, what we do is we say low is 0, high is 1. Okay? That gives us two possible states. We call those things bits. A bit, either a 0 or a 1. Okay? It's like a digit, but only has two things instead of 10 it can store. Now, except for Boolean, we usually want more than two values. So what we do is we take several bits together. If I take two bits, the first one can be 0, 1, the second one can be 0, 1, that's four possible options. If I take three bits, I get eight options. If I take four bits, I get 16, and so on, right? I take 30 bits, I've got about a million options. So we have this bucket of bits that are voltages, high or low. There's lots of ways they could be arranged. And then the other part of this that happens is interpreting what I mean by a particular sequence. Here's a question here.
For the higher low voltages, can it store something like really high and then just a little bit high? Is it making this
thing? Good question. Can we store more than just high and low? Yes. But the problem is the space needed in your chip to recognize three voltage levels instead of just two is more than the space needed to store two pieces that only store one. So it's more effective for us to only store high and low because the pieces can be so small we can store lots of them together. Okay? So then we take whatever sequence of bits and we have rules for how this particular sequence of bits means a number, means a character, means a string, means whatever it is it means. So for example, this particular sequence 0110111 means 119, or it means a lowercase w. Okay, depending on what we expect to find in the bucket, we'll interpret it in different ways. So it's a combination of what we store in memory and the type we expect to be there that tells us the value. So if I were being really pedantic about this, over in my heap here, what I should have put here was just large numbers of 0 ones forever. Okay? On and on and on. And then what Java does is it says, okay, this chunk right here, that is the number of this kitten. And this next chunk right here, that is its weight. And this next chunk right here, that's where to find what kind of fur it has. And all the garbage collector's really doing is saying, you can reuse this space. It's no longer talking about something valid. Okay? But the mapping is basically just we come up with some mapping between a bunch of ones and zeros and the values we are interested in. Next class, we'll talk about that in a little bit more detail and talk about how that matters as we're writing code with types. But for now, that's what I wanted to say about creating and destroying objects. I will see you all on Monday.